Thank you for attending session 378 titled Ask a Sex Therapist. On behalf of Sunstone, we want to thank you for attending Sunstone and attending the closing evening session on Saturday. Following this session, there will be an epic Mormon potluck at the park just east of the venue, 5 minutes away, and hopefully the weather holds. A comedy show and kickball game between Mormon fundamentalists and ex-Mormons. Tickets are $10 as a donation to Sunstone and available for purchase at the registration desk. We would love to have you all join. Look to the printed program for instructions to get to the park. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Please silence your cell phones and remain respectful. As you leave us tonight, we want to thank you all for coming and being part of the Sunstone Symposium. You have now participated in a tradition of Mormon history that is over 40 years long. The restoration tradition can be what we make it, and your participation helps make Mormonism a little more diverse, interesting, and inclusive. Please support Sunstone by making a donation, subscribing to the magazine and podcast, and by attending our regional conferences. Our next conference will be in London in September. There is nothing like traveling the world with your favorite Sunstone friends. Please join us. Sunstone cannot exist without your financial support. We want to keep this community growing into a healthy, vibrant way to engage Mormonism. Thank you for being part of that. This session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework so that folks can get out for dinner on time. About this presentation, come enjoy a candid Q&A where any question is welcome. This has been a well-attended session in the past where sexual topics can be broached in a sex-positive, evidence-based, and humorous approach. Coming from a culture where sexuality can be treated in rigid ways, it can be healing to have a safe space to talk openly about questions and concerns. Natasha Helfer Parker is the owner and founder of Symmetry Solutions. She is a licensed clinical marriage and family therapist in the states of Kansas and Wisconsin, and a certified sex therapist. Natasha has been in practice for over 20 years and works with adults and adolescents. She specializes in mental health therapy, sex therapy, and sexuality concerns, family and couple services, and faith transitions within the spiritual journey. And now for the presentation.
Thank you. I don't know. You should wait to see if you want to clap. But I thought, yes. So Lisa's passing around paper and pens because if you do not want to necessarily ask your question publicly because, you know, we're doing the sex shame thing well, then we're going to give you a chance to write down your question and we'll collect a bunch of them. So if you're the only one who wrote down a question, hopefully we won't know that it's you anyway, because we want to keep you being able to do your sexual shame well. And, you know, we'll protect it. So I thought it was an interesting metaphor that our great sex talk evening here was basically the hardest room to get to. You had to really work hard to get here. It's also at a time when we're really tired and not energetic, which is usually about the time we try to prioritize sex in our normal lives. So, yeah, a lot of good things to kind of draw from. But I thought today we would talk about sex, baby. Talk about you and me. And I am a certified sex therapist. So that means that I've gone to about 3 years of extra training. I don't know why my... Sorry. That's good. It's good to talk about feedback. If something isn't happening well during the encounter, don't just put up with it. I actually say, that's not working for me. I'd like for you, your voice to be a little softer. Thank you, Janine, for contracting with me on that very important thing that was annoying you and would probably keep you from climaxing with me. Thank you. All right, so that means that I've received 3 years of extra training. So this was not just like a workshop I attended or a weekend certification that I got. And it rocked me to my little Mormon girl core. So although I'm sure many of you think I'm very progressive and revolutionary, my A-sect members think I'm weird and rigid and frigid, and that's the world I continually go between. So I have with me Lisa Butterworth and Jennifer White. They both work for me at Symmetry Solutions, and they both are currently under supervision for becoming A-sect certified sex therapists as well. So they're in that process of getting that same training that I did. So I'm really proud to have them here with me and encouraging them to start, being in these kinds of spaces with me as well. So we are going to give about 5 different slides of just some very basic sex positive information and framing. And what I would like for you to think about as you're sitting here with me, I have no idea where you're at in the spectrum of Mormonism, and I have no idea where you're at in the spectrum of your sexuality and your sexual wounds or successes or joys or sadnesses. So that's a lot of sexual space to hold. I do use a lot of humor, and in my humor, I am in no means trying to minimize your pain or trying to dismiss something that may be very painful for you. So just know that that's my style, because I feel if we don't laugh, we cry. And I guess most of the time I choose to laugh, but I do a fair amount of crying as well. This is not really meant to be a place where we're going to deal with sexual trauma, but many of us have had sexual traumatic experiences, probably about, statistically, a good third of us, and the number seems to be more. So take care of yourself. If I offend you, if I'm saying something that, even if I don't offend you, feels uncomfortable, step out, go get a glass of water, write me a nasty message on Facebook. All of that is totally welcome. And because, I sometimes when I'm speaking, I'm thinking of a certain group of people, and then I'm like, oh, that wasn't the best way to say it for a different group of people, right? So that's kind of the space I'm in. But I don't mean to offend, and I understand that there's a lot of sensitivities in this room because sexuality kind of hits at the core of our identities in many ways. The other thing I want to say is the discomfort meter. So oftentimes when we think about sex, we think about, am I comfortable or am I not? So it's a yes or a no. And most things in life are not that simple. So I would say if you're at a 10, which means you're in full-blown panic attack mode, you're hyperventilating, sweating, you're having big-time heart palpitations, you've got a knot in your stomach, please take care of yourself and step out. And if you're at a 9 or an 8 or a 7, do that as well. If you're at a 3 to a 5, I'm happy. I want to make you that uncomfortable, because that's where we grow and change. And if you're squirming in your seats, it like makes me actually happy. So I'm so sorry that your discomfort makes me slightly happy and I get off on it, but not sexually off on it. So don't worry. I will not go home and masturbate to any of your images tonight. I promise. I promise. Okay, so hopefully we're hitting the 3 to 5 right now. And I do a lot of that intentionally, not just because I want to be funny, although I do enjoy being funny. We are not used to sexual language. We do not use correct anatomy, language. We just don't talk about sexuality in ways that kind of normalize the sexual experience. We're all in sexual bodies in one way or another. Even asexual folks, will typically masturbate a few times a year and have a sense of sexuality, although they're orienting as asexual, which is perfectly fine. So I think that's all of my disclosures. Do we have disclosures? Okay, so let's go ahead and go ahead with some of the slides. So are you comfortable talking about this?
I can talk about the next slide.
Okay, so sexual health is something that is a thing, believe it or not. although most insurance companies would not agree with that. And also, most of our legal system will not agree with that. So a lot of times, especially in a puritanical system like we all came from, sexual health is seen as a frivolous, or sexuality is seen as something frivolous, something that you just kind of, you know, if you have it, you're kind of lucky, but you shouldn't prioritize it, and you definitely shouldn't make room for it in lieu of other many more important things, like pretty much everything. And so it totally ignores a very integral part of our identity. So we have our biology, we have our psychology, we have our emotions, we have our sociology, and we have our sexuality. So these are all very different, very important integral parts of our identity. So the World Health Organization has come out with this statement about sexual health, that it is a thing, that we all have a right to it, and they have many more documents that are very interesting to read as far as helping you. In fact, I would encourage you to Google it and read the World Health Organization's kind of document of what your sexual rights are. And it's interesting that when I did that, Mormonism pretty much breaches about 80% of your sexual rights. Okay. So that's important to know, that that's where we come from, whether you're a believer or not a believer or whatever. That's just, it's just the reality. And it's sad to me, because I've done a podcast on sexual positivity in Mormonism. Compared to a lot of other Christian cultures, at least, I feel like we have a lot of sex positive potential in Mormonism. We do a really bad job of living our best stuff. That's just sad and all around in lots of different parts of our theology. Okay, next.
So I was so excited when I learned about these different principles of sexual health. It really gives great language to talk to. I use these a lot to talk with my clients to give them language, just the importance of each one of these. So there's consent, and just so you know, there's so much we could go into to each of these. There's a podcast on each one of these that's at least an hour. But yeah, there's consent, being non-exploitive, protection from HIV and STIs and unwanted pregnancy, honesty, shared values, and mutual pleasure.
Okay, go back to that other slide really fast. So what I want to just encourage you to think about when we're thinking about, I mean, usually most of us grew up with this idea that marital sex was healthy sex. That would be protective, healthy sex. So make sure you get to marital sex. I can guarantee you that about 90% of the people who've come through my door that are active members of the church, temple holding, pew sitting, wonderful, beautiful people, are not following the six principles of sexual health. And what's interesting is that some college kids, not all of them, but some of them in a hookup with zero connection are following the six principles of sexual health. So just percolate on that one for a minute.
Yeah, and a little bit about each one of these to kind of give you context, some things to think about. So with consent, is there a clear yes from their body language? Is that verbal? Is it safe to say no? You know, a lot of people have had sexual trauma, and maybe they're going into that freeze state. So checking in with your partner and seeing where you're at, seeing where they're at, is so important. And so just having that option to always say no. Being non-exploitive. This is something that happens a lot, and I think sometimes unintentionally this happens a lot. So what, if any, are the power imbalances? Is information being withheld from one partner? Is guilt being used to kind of shame the other person, whether it's to have less sex or to more sex? protection for HIV and STIs and unwanted pregnancy. So basically having that safe sex talk beforehand is very important. Yeah, so this is where one night stand, you really can have all these principles. Sometimes it's not in marriage. Honesty. So how transparent are you being? Are you sharing your wants and your desires, your fantasies? I mean, this is very vulnerable. And even people that we've been married to for a long time, this can be really hard. But making space for that can just bring so many opportunities for just beautiful intimacy and sex. Shared values. And what that is, like, really about what sex means to you and what it means to the other person. Because this doesn't mean the same thing to everything. Sex for each of us doesn't have to look the same. There's not one right way to do this. And mutual pleasure. Is it really being satisfying to both? Is it meeting both people's needs? This one I feel very strongly about. Sex is for both people. Yeah.
And I've done a and I've done a podcast with Doug Braun Harvey, who is the founder. He's kind of a fabulous kind of uprising sex therapist within our country right now. And he did a podcast of very lovingly offering me tons of time to reach out to the Mormon community. He's like, oh my gosh, I'm going to get to reach out to the Mormon community. And so he was excited, and he's done a podcast on each of these principles with me at Mormon Sex Info. So if you want to Google that, you can find that. All right. Do you want to talk about this?
So I remember, like, where is this from? Isn't it from Tina Sellers? Right, okay. So Tina Sellers... one of her students. So she works within non-Mormon communities, but other Christian sort of communities that have many of the same experiences that we have had. And I've heard her tell the story of why they came up with this definition, because they were, you know, writing books, and then they realized there was no definition to talk about sexual shame. So how do we talk about sexual shame if nobody's ever even defined it? So that is just an interesting comment on shame in general, right? Like, we don't talk about it. And so we don't have definitions for it. And so do you want me to read it? Or do you got it? Okay. Okay. Sexual shame is a visceral feeling of humiliation and disgust towards one's own body and identity as a sexual being, and a belief of being abnormal, inferior, and unworthy. This feeling can be internalized, but also manifests in interpersonal relationships, having a negative impact on trust, communication, physical and emotional intimacy. Sexual shame develops across the lifespan. In interactions with interpersonal relationships, one's culture, society, and subsequent critical self-appraisal, a continuous feedback loop. So, like, we think these thoughts, other people tell us these things, we get these messages over the pulpit or from the community, and all of these things reinforce each other eternally into this lovely, disgusting stew of shame. There is also a fear and uncertainty related to one's own power or right to make decisions, including safety decisions, related to sexual encounters, along with an internalized judgment towards one's own sexual desire. That one, I bet we all identify with, an internal judgment towards one's own sexual desire. Which, speaking of things that are hard to say, has anybody noticed how hard it is to say, ask a sex therapist? Asks. It's really hard to say, ask a sex therapist. You have to really go for the k. Anyway, so I mean, that's pretty detailed, but I think it's important that you go through every step of that, right, in order to identify what the experience is like, because when it isn't named and you're just feeling that visceral feeling and you don't understand all the subsequent, like, stuff there, it gets sort of stuck in that place of internalized judgment, right? But recognizing that it's a whole system and that it is a normal experience for people coming from many contexts.
Having a name for support is so validating and just kind of like normalizing how many people experience this. And I use this all the time in therapy, bringing out this definition and exploring it.
And please don't think that this is a Mormon problem, right? So, I mean, just if you grew up in the United States of America just with commercials and bulletin boards and the types of ways that we've perceived successful sex that we've seen, I mean, what have we seen? We've seen young bodies. We've seen fit bodies. We've seen white bodies for the most part. We've seen heterosexual bodies. We've seen bodies who climax in the same moment at the same time without any communication bodies. We've seen bodies that really could care less about birth control. We've seen, you know, I mean, just the types of things that we've seen give us no actual realistic expectation to what it takes to have healthy, integrated, pleasurable sexual experiences with another person. So we're all in this boat stew together as Americans, and Mormonism just kind of has a few little, you know, kind of interesting quirks that add, you know, some interesting issues with our sexual shame. So please don't, you know, think that, oh, if I just wouldn't have been Mormon, I would have been having amazing, wonderful sexual experiences at the age of 21. Not likely. Not likely. Okay. So with that, I think we're ready to just kind of open up to the mic. So if you have a question that you want to write down, make sure you do that. And in about 10 minutes, Lisa will collect those. And we'll collect them, even if you don't have necessarily a thing, just hand in your paper. So we're collecting a lot of papers. And then I just want to say before we start that I think we should all give each other a pat on the back just for being here. Like, you are the bravest people at Sunstone right now to want to interact with Natasha Helfer Parker about sex. Come on. Like, give yourself some credit, right? And what happens in 300D definitely stays in 300D, okay? So we're gonna talk, we're gonna explore, we're gonna think, we're gonna disagree, we're gonna feel liberated, we're gonna like feel shitty, whatever it is, we're gonna be okay, because tomorrow's another day. With that, go to the mic. Who's our first brave soul?
I have teenagers.
Yay! Because they're not sexual.
We're entering this like new area where we don't have like the church telling us everything, because that's not what we're doing right now. And I'm like thinking like cognitively, you know, what our ages, you know, trying to be positive, but be a mom. You know, a good mom. Okay.
So is your question, if I heard you right, is it how do I start sex positive, sexual education types of approaches with children who are in teenage years, which probably scare the bejesus out of me, because it was so easy within the construct of Mormonism to just say, just don't do anything until you're married, and therefore I'm say, check, I'm done as a mom, and now this is a lot harder. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, and in some ways thinking, oh, thank goodness, I don't have to be so bad on them, but then like, oh, wait a second, how, you know, when do they need, like, mom to say, whoa?
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Right. So we don't want to go from one extreme and micromanage every aspect of their sexuality, right, to another extreme, which is anything goes and just go have fun. So I like to make a lot of metaphors around driving for this, right? So the only difference between driving and sex is that our kids actually watch us drive from the time that they're babies, right? Well, some babies might watch us have sex, but hopefully by the time they're two, you've kind of cut that out. All right, so anyway. Actually, babies go to sleep really well while parents have sex, so that's nice and soothing for them. All right, so I think it's really clear. Okay, so for two things. One is to get really clear on what are your sexual values. And remember that values are not a do-not list. You don't want your values to be based on a to-do-not list, which is basically what we were all raised with. Do not masturbate. Do not have premarital sex. Do not have any sexual thoughts. What, we all failed at those, yes.
And also, it's kind of liberating to let them decide what their sexual values are.
But be clear first on what your sexual values are, because every parent has a right to teach their kids their sexual values. Within that construct, then you say, but guess what? Like Lisa said, you also have a right to your sexual values, and you may not always agree with mine, but this is why I have these sexual values, and this is why we as your parents think that they're the best kind of course. And this is, you know, these are a good place to start, but the values can be a lot more than just these six principles. So for example, you could say, you know, in my experience, my values have to do with sexuality being something that we experience with people we love. That's one value. Another person might be like, well, in my experience, sexuality is something to be explored, and whether or not love is part of the equation, it shouldn't matter. Those are two different values. Whether or not you agree with that, you know, so what are your values and why do you have them? So if your value is, I'd like, you know, for you to experience sexuality with people you love, well, why? Because for me, yeah, I'm a big fan of the for me, it's special. It's something that you don't do with just everybody. It's something that, you know, has emotional maybe ramifications for some people, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So be clear on that. But just like driving, even if your kids share your values, I mean, who has the value of having a car accident? Nobody. So we put the kid in the car and they're like, yep, I agree, mom. Yep, I should stop at the red light. Mm-hmm, got it, thanks. Crash! So your kid may have sexual experience, one, because they don't share your values and they think you're full of crap because they know better than you, you know, because, well, what else do teenagers have to do? But second, they may actually do agree with you and still have a sexual experience and then not know how to manage that. And so what do we do with our driving teens? We buy insurance for them. Do we buy insurance for them because we're giving them permission to have an accident? No. But I can't tell you how many parents I've talked to that it's like, well, if I provide birth control or if I teach or if I educate, I'm giving permission for my child to have sex. And the research does not support that. If you want your kids to have sex, do not talk to them about it, tell them not to do it, don't give them any resources. I can guarantee you, your kids will have a great, crappy sexual life starting at about 15 or 16. So good luck with that, Mormons.
And think about this in any other context. You know, we talk about how important education is. People make better decisions the more education they have. And this is so true when it comes to sex. People deserve. I mean, that's a human right to know what's going on with your body and to have that education. Yeah, that's actually part of the sexual bill of rights or whatever.
It is the rights. Bill of rights.
Yeah, sexual bill of rights. Okay.
No, good. And grab the mic from me at any point, you guys, because I'm a talker schmocker. All right, so the other thing I want to say is this is also, so the Europeans, well, some of the Europeans, they're teaching their kids about sex from like kindergarten on, and they are beating us on every single statistic out there. Unwanted pregnancy, delay of penis and vagina, and penis and anus in their PIV, penis and vagina. No, it's not intercourse, penetration, it's not either. Okay, I just had a like, whoop. All right, what? Nope. I had such a smart word to just sound so smart on, and now I'm just sitting here. But they're, yes, they're waiting longer to have penis in vagina and penis in anus penetration. Let's just say that, even though that's not the word. And which are the riskiest types of sex as far as STIs and as far as unwanted pregnancy. That do not think that they're all sitting at church on pews. No, they're rubbing up against each other. They're jacking each other off. They're having oral sex. They are masturbating. They're being sexual, but they're waiting for sexually risky behaviors much longer, quite longer than we are. So our age is typically 17, 18, and theirs is like 20, 22, right? So it is interesting. So, and we know without a shadow of a doubt that the abstinence model is putting especially our most vulnerable, naive kids at risk. So it's usually the good girls that get pregnant. You know, the naughty girls kind of figured it out, right? Which, of course, is just so difficult for me to understand all this. So think about masturbation even as something that you're teaching your kids about. Masturbation is the Lord's way of self-reliance. Right? Right? And isn't that one of our best principles? Be self-reliant. You do not need to wait to get married. You don't need to depend on anybody. You don't need to guilt your wife. You don't need to... I mean, masturbation is like this wonderful way for us to self-regulate when another person is not available to us or when we are not ready to be with another person. What a wonderful gift. And we, the arms were created to reach just right.
And with that, we're respecting other people's consent and what they're ready for too. And so this is one of these, our values about health and about healthy sexuality.
And the things that we've been told about masturbation just make me go a little cuckoo, because we are touching ourselves from the womb. A fetus, or I guess, you know, a baby that's developed enough to be able to touch itself, will linger longer in the genital area than any other area of touching itself. So it's self-soothing, it's natural, and we've made it in, when we make natural acts unnatural and sinifies them, we make problems for everybody. And the sexual shame is deep from the very beginning. So I hope, is that enough? Also, just to let you all know, sextalkwithnatasha.com. I've done a series, 10-part series on parenting.
I want to add one thing, because this is something. This is something that I never, ever, ever hear about moms telling their teenage sons, but I think it's super important, because we have framed sex education in terms of like medicalizing and like keeping people safe. We never talk about pleasure, especially for girls, right? Like, we expect that boys are going to get pleasure out of teenage sex. We do not expect that for girls, and girls do not expect it for themselves. And I wish every American mother would sit their teenage sons down and say, kids, if your girlfriend is not having fun, if you don't know, if you're not checking in with her that she's having fun, you are not a good boyfriend. And you are not experiencing the real joys that sex can give you. Because when you really make her enjoy that, that's going to be the bomb, right? Like, if you're all about you having an orgasm, that is missing the point. And how many teenage boys hear that? Zero.
The orgasm gap is real, even with adults. It's at about 30% less orgasms for women than men. And we do have a very male-centric way of teaching sexuality. So a lot of women will tell me, well, I get pleasure from giving my boyfriend a blowjob. Which is fine. There's nothing wrong with having pleasure from giving pleasure. But then when I ask about the reverse, they're like, well, that makes me uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable being pleasured because then the focus is on me. We have been socialized as women to focus our pleasure on pleasuring men. And so that's a whole nother
issue. Having some education around the clitoris is definitely important.
Being clitorate. And there's a book on that by Dr. Mintz, who I love. You should all follow her on Facebook. She's got great quotes and memes. But also, and I know Lisa didn't mean this, but just a quick shift on wordage. It's not that boy's job to make the woman have pleasure. It's the woman's job to know her pleasure and for a boy to be curious about that and to be willing to lean into that. Okay, so we own our own sexuality first, and then we share it and educate the partner. Because then you get into this huge, weird, horrible stuff that we're either good lovers or not good lovers, and we're not like people who have ESP, really. So we just really need to understand and learn each partner we're with. What your last girlfriend liked may not be anything like what your new girlfriend likes. And we're not even talking about intercourse. We're talking about kissing or holding hands or, you know, even just having your arm around. Some people are very touchy-lovey and some people get a little, you know, antsy with that. So these are important principles to think about just in dating practices. Don't talk about these things just in the sense of sex.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so sometimes I feel like I don't know what I don't know. So, I mean, in working with, you know, the LDS population, are there any just one or two things that you find that we just don't even realize that we're completely missing? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a good question. Huh. Of all the things.
Sorry, I think the what? Yeah, give it to us now.
Well, I do think that one thing that we are missing is this idea of self-ownership of sexuality. I think we're very much tied into the Western romantic notion that we belong to somebody else. And if you even listen to all the love songs, that's what it's all about. You belong to me, and I belong to you, and we're just going to run off into the sunset and own each other and then be really pissed off when you do something that I don't like, and then that's going to really help us be so intimately in love. And then we wonder why we're all like just struggling and feeling like we are kind of sleeping with the enemy. Right? We've been pitted against each other since the beginning. And Mormonism has definitely bought into that. You know, men want certain things. We talk about men in this general way. You know, they're the sexual aggressors. They all want sex. So you Mormon guys probably grew up with this idea of like, holy crap, I want sex and I need to learn how to control that. Right? So if I want to be a good Mormon boy, which most of you actually do want to be that, like, I like working with Mormon men. They're very nice for the most part. But they've at least been normalized that they want the sex. So they just have to, you know, wait until they can have it. The part where you guys get a little weird on us is that you feel like you've deserved it because, you know, you waited so long and plus you went on a good mission and so you were supposed to get some hot one of us and be able to have sex for the rest of your life anytime you wanted. So then you get a little weird on us, but you're still fairly nice. Women, on the other hand, you know, have been told, watch out for that penis that wants you. Right? It's coming to get you. And then you're like, well, what if I want it? Whoop, not supposed to want it. Nope, I don't. Wait. Okay, so if I want it and it wants me, but no, I can't have it. So there's two problems there for women. One is that the man is already posited as the enemy and then we marry him. And that's supposed to change in a day how we feel about that. And two, if we were the desire person that actually desired sexuality, then that was shamed on us as well. So we became gatekeepers of men and gatekeepers of ourselves. in ways that I don't think men deal with. So the repression of sexual development in Mormon women, I find that very, very deep. And it's interesting to me, as the asexuality movement has moved forward, which is great, the high amount of Mormon women I get coming in saying they think that they're asexual, which is much, 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 much higher than I would say the actual statistics about asexuality nationwide, which is at about like less than 1%. And I'd say 20% of my Mormon women are coming in wondering about that. It's not asexuality. It's that the sexuality was like pummeled out of you. And you trained your body not to be sexual. And you trained your body to tense up. And you trained your body not to have these thoughts. And when we go back in the developmental cycle, that's usually what I see from women. Well, I had thoughts. I married the guy that I didn't have those thoughts for. Yeah, so if you're married to a guy that you married because he didn't have sexual chemistry, yeah, I'd be feeling asexual too. Right? So we set it up, actually. I mean, who in your young women's list had to come up with a list about what you were looking for in a priesthood man? How many of you put, he has to be hot and turn me totally on that list? Ruth! I'm so happy. Aw, I love you even more now. I'm so excited. Oh, that just turned me on. All right, so... The what? So asexuality is kind of on the orientation. So if you hear LGBTQIA, a lot of people don't understand what the I and the A. I is intersex. So these are the people who are born kind of with hormonal shifts that don't really put them in the male-female category as clearly as most of us. And I forget, I think it's at 3% are intersexual. I'm it's hard sometimes for me to pull out those statistics, so...
I don't remember what the percentage is, but it's the same as the number of redheads.
Pretty cool. Yeah, don't correlate those two, remember. Research and causation and correlation is a big problem that we have, especially in sexuality. But A is the asexual. And so these are people who really say, you know what? I really orient towards not wanting to have sexual experiences in my life, especially with another person. And we, as a community, are sick and tired of therapists and doctors and partners telling us that we are broken. Like, why is that not necessarily a orientation? I may have, you know, arrived in this world wired not, you know, towards sexuality. Most of us understand high libido, low libido. But these are people who really just, I'm not interested in that type of experience in my life. However, the research does show that there is slight masturbatory practices, even in asexual folks. So, yeah.
So I have one question that is, it's probably a pretty simple answer. I'm really curious about it. But I also have another question that is probably massively complex and may lead to a long discussion that could be very worthwhile.
Okay.
I don't know which question to ask.
Why don't you ask both and I'll just decide what and if we'll take the time for it.
Okay. Easy question. What is the role of pornography in healthy sexual partnerships and beyond partnerships, but you know, even to constellations? And then the big question, do you want to answer that before?
No, I just wanted to add that there's a couple questions that are like that, and I just want to read those along with that one.
Oh, okay.
So can someone have a healthy relationship with porn erotica, or is the only healthy relationship one of non-use? And then the other one, is pornography bad? So like the in the realm, like we can talk about that,
right.
All
so
three
that's
together.
Number one.
Okay. Second question, probably a bit more complex. How is it possible to navigate ethical and consensual polygamy? I'm not saying polygyny. I'm not saying polyandry. I'm saying polygamy. And is it possible, and is it, without jumping into upside down land, is it possible to have healthy consensual polygamy within a Mormon theological framework?
Okay. I actually think the second question is very easy. Okay, so I think that any time any sexual act is dependent. Okay, if your salvation is dependent on any sexual act, it will never be healthy. That's it. So there can be polygamy. If you want to marry more than one person and it's legal in your country or whatever, and it's beneficial to all parties, and all parties are consensual, and there's no exploitation. But to tie it to salvation is of itself exploitative. So that's just the reality of it. And yeah.
Is that just sexuality, or is that marriage?
I would say, really, quite frankly, anything that is tied to salvation by an entity that isn't yourself is exploitative, which makes us think of a lot of the things that we're doing. Tithing. Okay, it's one thing to give of your free will because it's your principle and value. It's another thing to have it tied to your salvation. So I think that's true of all things. Marriage, whether there's sex involved or not, I think it's the same thing. Anything you want to say about that?
So I would agree with everything Natasha just said. And I would say that, like, I have definitely met people in polygamous relationships that really try to live with as much moral, ethical framework as they can. And they can be very moral, ethical people. But it doesn't change the fact that the framework is exploitative.
I would agree with that.
I mean, in some ways, we're all doing this. Okay, monogamous Mormon relationships are tied to salvation. So that would count too. I'm just saying, so it's all unhealthy when it's coming from that perspective. So we all live in a muck of unhealth, hopefully in the best ways possible. Okay, anything you want to add to that? Okay, pornography. All right, so this is what's interesting to me, is that we have tended to decide as a kind of a group. And by that group, I mean just as a people, and I don't even mean a Mormon people, that certain sexual things are just either bad or good, no matter what. And that's just not true. Like marital sex, that's good. But rape happens in marital sex. Masturbation, you know, some people think that's good, some people think it's bad. I think it can be done in ways that are healthy and ways that are unhealthy. Just like me eating donuts can be done in ways that are unhealthy or healthy. So I'm interested, I find it interesting that we like to blame concepts or things instead of how they're used. I know, couples where erotica and pornography has created very toxic, hurtful dynamics in their relationship. Typically because, one, it doesn't fit into their value system, and two, because they haven't contracted it, so now it's in the realm of betrayal, because nobody knew that, one person didn't know that was happening. But that's not pornography's problem. That's values' problem, and that's contracting's problem. Okay, because I also know couples that use erotica and pornography to enhance their sexuality, to solve issues like anorgasmia, to just be playful and creative and fun, because it does fall under their shared values, and because they are honest about it, and because they find it mutually pleasurable. So again, that's not to pornography's credit. I'm not saying, oh, pornography's great, because some people use it in a way that benefits them. So I'm neutral on pornography from that perspective. Now, I think there's another perspective of pornography, which is ethics, you know, and a lot of people care about that. How is pornography created? What are the sexual rights of? But if you're worried about that, I would hope that you're worried about the lipstick in your purse. I would hope that you're worried about the nail salon person that you just visited that you pay $10 to because the American lady, you know, she charges $60. These are issues of ethics that we have in every aspect of our business and industry. But we have ethical dilemmas more about sex workers than we do any other worker, which we also exploit, many of them. So then we also like to project our own issues of sexual exploitation on workers who would rather you not do that to them. So it's one thing to be sexually trafficked, where you're forced into sexual work, where it's another thing to be a sexual worker of your own volition and to have a bunch of puritanical people say, oh, you're broken because you're a sex worker. They are not very pleased with us. And they're not any more or less broken than the rest of us who go to our jobs, and some of us like them and some of us don't. But we're interested in making a living, and we sell ourselves short sometimes in that process, and sometimes we make it well. It's an industry. So the best way to do that is to pay for your porn and be very clear about where you're getting it from. And Utah's number one on paying for porn. So we're doing something right.
So I just want to address a couple of these quick questions, like, that I think will be fairly quick. Sure. And then, no, but you could be right here, I think. I don't know, Natasha.
One quick comment. My porn shoulders.
If you're interested in this topic, there's a really great book by David Lay. The name of it is kind of funny, but it's called Ethical Porn for Dicks.
But don't
both his name and his title is bad, but it's really good information.
Okay, so there's one that just says best resources ? And I will just handle this. I will say, I don't know what resources you want, but generally, Natasha Helfer Parker's webpage is a really good place to get good resources, which a long list of things.
Thank you.
I would say men and women, like, Come As You Are has the most up-to-date research on women's sexuality, and it is brilliant and amazing. And everyone should read that. There's also one on sexual shame.
Emily Nagowski, Nagowski.
And I did a podcast with both David Lay and Emily Nagowski on Mormon Sex Info.
Okay, so best resources. Resources, this one I don't know, and I kind of feel like this is a problem in all of America. Best resources for sex ed for trans teens.
Okay, so it's lame that I don't know this off the top of my head, so I'm just going to own that. But I do have it, I'm pretty sure, on natashaparker.org. And if anybody messages me, I will make sure and get you, private message me on Facebook, and I will absolutely get you resources on that, because there are really great resources. I'm just totally lame. I work with Mormons and sexual shame, and although I'm totally trans-affirming, I probably am not as... It's not off the top of my head as much, so
I apologize. And, you know, part of the problem is there hasn't been a lot of research on this yet, right? Like, it just doesn't exist. So there's good resources written by people who have experience, but the research isn't there yet. So
the Department of Human Health Services actually has some very good best standards of care now for transgender individuals. Excellent standards of care. Sarah, do you have anything that you would come to mind for trans teens?
Just need to name that there is a lack of resources in general in comparison to heterosexual resources.
Absolutely.
For our LGBTQIA plus family. And then that's even less within our LGBTQIA plus Mormon family. So oftentimes what we're having to do for resources for members of those communities is looking to outside specialties. So GLAAD has some really, really good resources for both parents and teens.
GLAAD, GLAAD.
We're seeing some additional research come out of major research hubs like UCLA, UCLA's Spectrum Clinic. Once again, you can also message me, and we have a lot more resources. But we need to name the deficit that's happening, and it's mostly coming from the advocacy, LGBTQ advocacy centers. I'm seeing some Trevor Project actually stand up and move forward into more sexual health areas, which is really exciting. But this needs to be done, and as sex therapists and emerging sex therapists, this is where we need to go.
Yeah, thank you. Go ahead and ask your question, yeah. Sorry, he had come up. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Come up to the mic, though, please, so that the recording can pick it up.
So I attend the Unitarian Universalist Church in South Valley in Cottonwood Heights, and they have a program called OWL, O-W-L,
yes.
Our Whole Lives.
Excellent program.
And that has comprehensive sex education for LGBTQIA people as well as heterosexual. And it's really comprehensive. It starts in elementary school. They have a junior high program, a high school, and an adult program.
Thank you. And that's a great resource for parents in general. Okay, go ahead.
So my wife and I started going through a faith crisis about a year ago, and we just barely started getting around to our kind of sexual reawakening, which is great. But so I've been listening to a lot of different podcasts from a lot of different sex therapists. A common theme that I see come up often is this idea that within a monogamous relationship, one person cannot meet all of your needs. And I'm wondering if you could kind of speak to that and kind of, I want to kind of pick your brain and get some of your thoughts on that idea.
So this fits with the theme of a couple other questions, so I'll read those too. I don't know if you're specifically talking about opening marriage, but that is something that we as sex therapists handle on a pretty regular basis. And so this one is there a way to broach the subject with a spouse? Important things to consider, negotiate. And then this one is basically, I'm not going to read it word for word, but it's basically a question of, if I am thinking in my Mormon monogamous marriage about exploring sexuality outside of my marriage, does that mean I'm a terrible person?
Okay. All right, so first of all, just because I would agree that in any relationship you're not going to get all of your needs met in one other person doesn't mean that I'm saying everybody go and ahead and start opening up your marriages. Okay, so I do think that they're two different things. I think that when we're saying a person should not expect to get all of their sexual needs met in a monogamous marriage is that we're saying your partner is going to be different than you in libido, in tastes, in preferences, in fantasies, and that's a reality that you need to learn how to negotiate. And if you want to be monogamous with your partner, that's something that takes a lot of skill and reflection and contracting and negotiation. And that needs to be ongoing because you don't stay the same sexual person at 50 that you were at 24 or at 80 that you were at 55. Okay, so again, there just to think about some of the things, and I do have I have webinars on how to manage sexual tastes and preferences that are different, and I have webinars on how to manage low libido, high libido partnerships, which, I mean, that's like, I'd say 85% of what comes into my sex therapy practice, because, wow, imagine I have an individual, they don't have the same libido as me, they don't have the same sex preferences as me. Huh, surprise. Although we seem to be surprised. We seem to be extremely surprised by this very normal part of life. And also health complications, pregnancies, age, shift this for everybody, you know, along the journey. So you may be the high libido partner for a chapter of your life together and then be the low libido later. It's interesting that actually, stereotypically, you know, we think of men being the higher libido partners. In my practice, I would say it's fairly 50-50 what I've seen. And also we tend to have the idea that it's men who want all the sex, and typically it's the men who are shutting down the sexual lifestyle of a couple in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and that has to do with the extreme shame that we have around erectile dysfunction, which is actually a normal part of aging. So, because, you know, we've tied, you know, penis erection with masculinity so closely that I'd rather not talk to my partner and just forget I'm a sexual person. Or only do it with my hand, which, you know, is more forgiving maybe than my wife. So, okay. So what was the point that I was trying to make? Shoot.
This is a very emotional, hard thing to really start to open up these hard discussions about and contracting our sexual lives. And a lot of us have been married for a long time and never done this, you know. And I like to refer to it as a working document that's going to continue to change. And it's okay. And there's no shame in needing help with that. I find that with just with another person in the room, with going to a sex therapist to help you do this, it's going to help a lot. Not that everyone needs that, but I think most it's normal to need that. It's very, very normal.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that there's lots of ways to manage that. So one is we need to get over our sexual egos, that if somehow my partner likes something that I don't offer, that's nothing to do about me. And that's, I mean, that's monumental. You think that's a simple sentence, but that's monumental. And even though I know that, I don't always feel that. So that's a difference too, right? We may know something, but when we're hit with something that we've been taught our whole life differently, it may feel very differently. So, you know, like if my husband likes, you know, blonde women, you know, with, I don't know, flat butts, and he married me, you know, then I'm like, what's wrong with me? And I really feel that way, right? And but it has nothing to do. He may have an erotic preference that, by the way, is not controllable. Our erotic preferences are not controllable. And yet he, because we're not just animals that have zero brain, he can push past that uncontrollable kind of erotic issue that, or not issue, erotic thing that he has, and fall in love with somebody like me. But he may, throughout his whole life, notice blonde women with flat butts. And if I take that personally every time he does that, then I'm in big trouble. And it's the same, I mean, gender doesn't matter. I mean, women have their own erotic preferences. So a lot of this, you know, I hear a lot of this with pornography, you know, with especially women. So women, we've been taught that we are sexual objects. And we've been taught that our main value is to be pretty and attractive and sexy, right? So we are very hypervigilant about that. And so I oftentimes, like an example, I guess I would give is there was a man who liked to watch porn of large-breasted Hispanic women. That was kind of his thing. And he was married to a white Mormon woman with like size B breasts. And so she's like, what the heck is he doing with me? And it felt like a very, you know, but I was like, well, do you like her breasts? Absolutely. Do you like your wife's body? Holy yes. Do you like to have sex with her? Please. I was like, okay, so we have, it's not a problem of attraction. Now he could have told me, yeah, I kind of made a mistake and I'm not really sexually attracted to my wife. People do get married to people they're not sexually attracted to, and that's its own issue. But for the most part, this erotic energy he had towards a certain fetish, if you want to call it that, had nothing to do with the amount of attraction and sexual desire he had for his wife.
One of the things that I think is, you know, also plays into this is that our sexual fantasies and preferences change over our lifespan, right? Like the things that young people find erotic are very different than the things that older people find erotic, right? Partly because when you're young, everything that is sexual is new and exciting. And new and exciting is actually the core of desire in many ways, right? And so young people tend to fantasize about really boring things because they haven't done them yet, right? Whereas, I mean, I'm not saying they're boring, but you know what I mean? Like, I've done that. I'm 45 years old. I've done all of that, right? And so that's not going to be as erotic and interesting as some of these other things that I haven't done, right? And so our sexual fantasies tend to get a little weirder as we get old, right? Because we haven't done those things. And so that kind of goes to this question of, like, am I a bad person for having fantasies about, like, opening my marriage or about other people? Or does that make me a bad person? Well, if it does, then pretty much all the people over 40 are bad people. Because all the people over 40 are fantasizing about this. Now, are we acting on it? Yeah, sometimes. Are we acting on it in healthy ways? Yeah, maybe not. Right? So, like, just because we fantasize about things, that can, you know, like, it doesn't necessarily mean we actually want to act on it, although sometimes it does. And neither one of those are right or wrong, right? Like, sexual fantasy has a whole, like, weight to it that, like, violent fantasy doesn't. Like, when we go to a violent movie, nobody's like, oh, yeah, I really want to go pick up guns and shoot everybody, right? Like, that's not something that we wonder about. And yet when we go to a sexually fantastic movie, people are wondering, well, do I really want to do that? Well, and sometimes maybe we do, right? It's hard because we don't necessarily have good ways of communicating or talking about which fantasies are just something that, like, light us on fire and help with the sex life we actually have and which fantasies we actually might want to work on. And so, yeah, like, again, going back to what Natasha said about porn, right? Like, these fantasies are neither good nor bad. But how are we using them in our lives towards our sexual health and our sexual identity and the sexual health and identity of our partner, right? Like, are they helping us to become more whole? Are they helping us to feel fulfilled? Or are we using them in ways that hurt ourselves or others or exploit or aren't consensual or aren't honest, right? All of those things matter. The context matters. The thing itself is neutral.
And that's why in monogamous marriages, you can use masturbation, you can use fantasy, you can use erotic imagery, you can use all kinds of things to incorporate what one partner may want and the other person doesn't in ways that still very much honor your monogamous contract. As far as getting, you know, I think hopefully everybody understands you don't get everything you want. So if you wish your monogamous partner would open up the marriage and that's a deal breaker for them, you have a choice to make and can say, okay, well, opening up the marriage is important enough to me that I am willing to breach this monogamous contract, and that comes with a lot of consequences as well. Or it's okay to say, you know what, probably in any sexual relationship or experience that I have, 70% satisfaction is probably a good expectation for me. So is it that important? Can I, you know, can I be a little sad that I don't get this type of sex? Because there's all kinds of other things that we've negotiated that work just fine for us. You're going to be in that position probably regardless. Does that make sense?
I did. I'm kind of echoing what's already been said. Maybe I'll say it in a different way. But the fantasies that we have and the porn that we watch doesn't always reflect what we want in real life. And so we don't have to always be threatened by that. And also, it is such an intimate, beautiful thing to kind of open up and share, if you have a partner, with them, what your fantasies are. That can be a lot of fun.
There's like a great like show. Well, I won't say great show. There's a show called Big Mouth. Your kids probably know about it and you probably don't. That's all I'm going to say about it. But there's one of the episodes is about this, you know, young man and he's watching gay porn and he gets an erection. And so the whole episode is about, well, does that mean I'm gay? And so they did a really actually, although crass and horrific that my 12-year-old is watching this, I'm also saying a wonderful job normalizing that experience for my 12-year-old who watches this show. Okay. Yes. I have kids who tell me they watch this show. That's a win, right? That's a win. I'm still having to self-soothe a lot. So. All right. Yeah, so fantasies, what Lisa was talking about is very common. As far as opening your marriage, that tends to be a new thing that we're really talking about much more openly in the public. It's been a thing forever, but it's something that seems to be gaining more popularity as we're facing kind of religious shifts all over the country, sexual value changes all over the country. We're living older than ever. You know, Esther Perel has this great comment that she says, you know, if you're married between the ages of, you know, 20 to 90, plan on having three marriages in your life. You just got to decide if it's going to be with the same person or not, because we go through so many developmental shifts in 60 years. You know, they never told us that when we were getting married in the temple, right? It was just like, this was it. This was the decision. Now we're good to go. Well, you know, you're going to be married to a very different person in about 30 years than you did that temple day. So that's so, but you have stuff, you have to recommit, you have to recontract, you have to renegotiate all the time. And that's the work that goes into a long-term relationship. But it's hopeful, because if you really do that type of work and you really love each other and there is natural sexual attraction that you at least had at one point, eroticism is possible. So yes, please.
Natasha, I am making my way out of a very extreme mindset. And you mentioned earlier that an extreme one way or the other isn't healthy. And I know a lot about what I don't want, what not to do, and what is bad. And as I'm trying to shift and build my own value system, I'm feeling a little bit lost, a bit lost. And so I'm wondering what it looks like for a female to take responsibility for her sexuality and understand it better.
That's a lovely question, and quite complex, because I think there's a lot of moving parts to that. I think the number one thing is to really get to know your anatomy. Every time I learn something new about my anatomy, which actually happened just a year and a half ago, I'm so fucking pissed. I mean, I'm a sex therapist trained by supposedly the best in the nation, and I'm still learning that I have erectile tissue around my urethra. That ticks me off. So, you know, having knowledge about your body is a big part of reclaiming yourself. The only other thing I'll say to that, because it's such, you know, I mean, it's obviously a complex question, and a lot of it is going to take practice, is don't be afraid of making mistakes. We've been told that mistakes will ruin us for life, right? All the object lessons, even the whole emotional stuff that I hear that sounds quasi-healthy. Oh, young people, don't have sex because you'll be too emotionally connected, and then it'll be harder when you break up. You know, you tell those stories, you believe those stories. If we were like, you know what, I hope you wait because I think it's more of an adult activity and you'll be better prepared. But if you don't, you'll survive. That's a story. Be very careful about the stories you tell yourself about mistakes or regrets, because you're learning. And you're probably going to have an experience where you're like, I don't know if I would. Okay, well, so I learned something. Instead of, oh my gosh, I sold myself short. I don't know if I'm a feminist. I don't know what I did. It's like, that's a big story. It's like, oh well. And then the other thing I would say about that is just this idea that I lost it.
She doesn't know, but this one I feel like is a little bit related. How much have you seen sexual shame affect female orgasm, and does it? And yes, obviously. How much? I mean, I think a lot, right? Like, we've got a big orgasm gap, right? Like, what is that about? Women are capable of so much pleasure, and we're not getting it. Why? Well, I'm going to say shame. mostly shame. So why does shame affect the orgasm? Oof, so many reasons, right? So our biggest sexual organ, as my friend Natasha Helfer Parker likes to say, is our brain, right? Like, our brain is our biggest sexual organ. And it is just inherent in the brainy part of sex that if we are feeling like, I am not enough, I'm not sexy enough, I'm not pretty enough, I'm not, right? And it's often put on that for us in our bodies.
Or it's wrong for me to be turned on by this.
Like, in that book that Jen talked about, Emily Nagowski uses the metaphor of a flock of birds, right? Like, orgasm is kind of like a flock of birds. It's kind of a miracle when they can all get flying in the same direction at the same time, right? And how do we make that happen? And I'm afraid that, like, actual flocks of birds are actually probably better at this than we are in our head, because there's so many parts of us that need to be on board with an orgasm, right? Like, our brain needs to be on board. Our, like, like, our body needs to be on board. If we're too cold, if we're hungry, if we're sweaty, if, you know, like, there's all kinds of things that can get in the way of us being able to be embodied in the moment. And if we don't know how to be in our bodies in the moment, right? Like, if that is not something that we are used to doing. There are so many women that I work with, and I'm going to include myself in this at times, where we feel like we are a floating head, that this part from here down doesn't exist for us. And if we're not paying attention to how all this feels, it gets very difficult to have an orgasm. Now, there are other things that can interfere with having an orgasm. So if that is a struggle for you, it might be the shame, and let's work on that. But there are also other physical things that can happen, right? Like, figuring out how to orgasm for some people is like a no-brainer. For some women, they can think themselves to orgasm. Or I have a friend who used to have trouble doing sit-ups during PE because she'd orgasm. And that is not my experience. and so, you know, like, it really is also about, like, exploring what's down there and how it feels to touch it in different ways, either by yourself or with someone else. It's looking at it, it's touching it in different angles and with different temperatures and with different things, right? Like, because some women, that's not gonna be an issue. They might still have fun doing that, but they're just gonna, like, boom, 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 orgasm, boom, I'm done, right? But for some women, it is a process of teaching yourself what, and it can take months or years, right? And that can be very frustrating, because we have this narrative that this is supposed to be something that just happens, right? Like, that's how it happens for most boys. Like, often their first orgasm happened when they were asleep. That happens for girls too. That's happened to me. I liked that. But less frequently, right? And so, yeah. So, shame, a lot.
So the thought that I had to finish up what I was going to tell you is, again, we're very binary on our yes and no's. I either like it or I don't. But the reality is, a lot of sexual activity or thoughts or fantasies, we really don't know yet. And so that same measurement that I said, be comfortable at a 3, 4, 5 in your consent model, if that makes sense. And of course, the minute it goes up higher than that, stop. And your partner should respect that. But I'm just saying, I don't want people to kind of correlate any discomfort to then that means I shouldn't be doing it, and that therefore I shouldn't be giving consent. Because I just think about the first time I wanted, you know, they told me about French kissing and how gross that seemed. And the first time I did it, it was kind of pleasurable, but kind of not. I was kind of grossed out a little. And yeah, I think we were 13, so I'm guessing he wasn't very good at it. I'm guessing I wasn't. So it was a little sloppy. And I mean, I was definitely at a 5 comfort level wise, but I still was doing it consensually, but I wasn't quite sure. And then, you know, over time, I mean, yeah, hello, let's do that. So does that make sense? So don't just write things off. Don't, and also back to the fantasy thing, don't yuck somebody else's yum. Don't yum somebody else's yuck. like, I like this, why don't you? Or, oh my gosh, that's disgusting, how could you like that? That's very important in marriages, especially if you're really going to open up. If you're surprised by something that your partner is turned on by, that's okay. And you might have to deal with some discomfort, but honor the fact that your partner is even sharing something that vulnerable with you. And just because your partner likes something doesn't mean you have to do it. So don't feel pressured by the fact that your partner's sharing something with you that is kind of like at a 9 or 10. We love the yes, no, maybe exercises, and there's some good kind of PDFs on Google if you just Google yes, no, maybe, to have conversations, to help you have conversations. Like, yes, absolutely, I'm into that. That's an absolutely no. There's no way I'm ever going to do that. And then there's a lot of maybes. And let yourself kind of have 3 to 5 times before you make a final decision. And even if you make a final decision then, believe it or not, 10 years from now, you may feel differently about that same thing. That's why the renegotiation is so important. Okay, did you?
It came back to kind of an earlier comment. One thing interesting, there is a little bit of research about marriage and partnerships that, and this would be heterosexual relationships, but when women are exploring that and even masturbating, that can actually improve their relationship and improve their sex life. But I want to honor that this is what we do, like, is going to look different for all of us, and it's okay if you're not comfortable with certain things. But certainly, as was already said, exploring yourself and sometimes masturbating for the intent of improving your sexual relationship, and then you can teach your partner what you like.
If your values really don't allow you to be comfortable with masturbation, I know many spouses that are willing to have their hand where you're guiding their hand, right? So that's another way to do kind of just exploration as a couple. Also, omgyes.com is a great resource to help women who do not understand how to orgasm to orgasm. I do not consider it pornographic. There are some like ways that they show you. It's very tastefully done. It's done by researchers and educators at I forget which university, but they're actually teaching you techniques, because we have this idea that, oh, everybody's going to orgasm differently. What they found out through the research that women are pretty reliable on 5 different techniques. So if you learn those, I think it's 5 to 7, something like that, then, I mean, it's a skill. It's like playing an instrument, right? So, and also, even though this may seem very unfair to women, like, what, guys just like, they're getting off pretty easily, and we have to do all this work, and you're sending me to omgs.com, like, what the heck? I'm just going to say, we have, like, I think 50,000 more nerve endings than men at the tip of our clitoris and the tip of their head. We have capacity for multiple orgasms where most men do not. And also, as we age, that whole thing seems to shift. So men have to, like, it's not as easy to just wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. They have to slow down because their erections aren't happening quite as fast. They need to kind of become more like what we stereotypically consider female-oriented towards their sexuality. Women tend to have flourishing, interesting rises around menopause and perimenopause and postmenopause that actually sometimes is very liberating. And for many women, they tend to hit a sexual peak. And so now it's much easier for her to orgasm. And so life is interesting. Life is interesting in this yin-yang kind of ideas around sexuality and male and femaleness, which, you know, is in of itself an issue, but it's interesting.
You know, I think it's Emily Nagowski talks about how, yeah, men can maybe have easier orgasms, but women have better orgasms. And I think that's, you know, like that we have maybe the capacity for a lot more pleasure. So this, I think, goes along with what you were just talking about, so I thought I'd bring it up. It was talking about, my sex drive can be compared to a willingness to get off the couch and do a workout. I'm lazy and I want to be pleasured, but I don't want to work for it physically. Where or how do I find the motivation? So one of the things I want to say about this is, this sounds like you're tired. It sounds like, you know, like lazy, I feel like, is often used as a shame word, right? Like if we don't want to figure out what's going on here, we label it as lazy. You're being lazy, right? So I would say that probably self-care is in order, that if you are, you know, maybe one of those pioneer stock, work hard and that's how we know that we're worth something. And, you know, like you're, if you're working yourself into the ground, if that, you know, if that's not the problem, then let's talk about something else. But if you're really working hard and you don't know what self-care looks like and you don't know how to rest, right? Like you're not going to feel motivated to have orgasms because you're going to feel motivated to take a nap. So, and that's just normal. And sometimes we're in phases of life where there's nothing we can do about that. And so what you can do about that is say, this isn't the phase of life where I'm going to have orgasms because I've got to get food on the table, right? There's, you know, like that's just, there's so many systems involved that, and then, you know, like I think also that there might be some room for like, digging into if you have the energy for it, right? Like if you don't have the energy to sex, you might have not have the energy to dig into this. But what is your relationship with pleasure in general, right? Like do you prioritize it for yourself? Do you make space for pleasure in your life? Do you think about like, oh, these are the six things I find pleasurable. How am I going to make sure those things happen for me in the next week? I mean, how many of us do that? But it's important because our bodies function better and we function better when we make pleasure a priority.
Well, this is a really interesting thing. We function under the myth that sexuality should just be happening organically and naturally and, you know, just it's just supposed to happen. I don't know anything else worth it in life that just naturally happens. I mean, if you want a career, you need to put a lot of work in it. If you want to have good kids, you need to put a lot of work into it. If you want, you know, whatever, you need to put a lot of work into it. And so although I'm very accepting of people's different styles and how much they do or do not want sex, I just did an interview with Barry McCarthy, who's also a very renowned sex therapist in our country. He's about 80 years old, and he's very frank. He's like, sex is part of your healthy lifestyle. And if you don't use it, you're going to lose it. And just like I force myself to go to the gym to swim 3 times a day, my wife and I have a date to have sex at least no smaller amount of time than once every 2 weeks. Because once you start having sex less than once every 2 weeks in a monogamous relationship, it starts becoming an anxiety loophole for those people usually. Like they start avoiding, they start, you know, so it becomes harder. And then he said, you got to just get with the program that like some workouts, it's just going to be good enough. Well, that was all right. And other times it's going to be like, wow, that felt really good. And do you know where he puts good enough sex at? 65% is good enough sex. About 20% is like phenomenal. And the rest of it, whatever math I'm doing, is kind of, ugh, that wasn't even good. So that's about right with my workouts. That about meshes. So again, having realistic expectations, prioritizing sex as part of your health outlook. And I know that we're almost out of time. Yeah.
Go ahead. Short answer. Okay, this one is about low desire, how to help your low desire partner feel desire, right? This is probably one of the number one things that we talk, that we address. And I would say, go to Natasha's podcasts and listen to the probably 6 or 7 hours that she has on that already, because we can't address it now. We don't have time, but it's a really good question.
And some of us are more of responsive desire. So some of us might have more of a responsive desire, where we kind of, we don't think we're in the mood, but then as soon as like maybe our partner starts, you know, doing some romantic things, and then we're like, oh yeah, now I'm in the mood.
But that may take a minute.
Yeah. So this one is, I've read that if you're between 1 and 5 on a Kinsey scale, you're technically bisexual. Do you agree? I think technically you are whatever you want to be. And technically, you can measure it however you want to measure it. And so if someone's telling you, well, technically, this is how it has to be defined, you could say, well, technically, I'm going to define it myself. So can you address anal sex and heterosexual marriage? Are there misconceptions about it? I mean, I think there's probably a lot of misconceptions about anal sex in general. I don't...
This is a new thing.
It is so good. Anyway, in my heterosexual marriage anyway. And apparently Natasha likes it. So Natasha has a webinar. Yes, there's a lot of misconceptions, right? Like, some people are never going to like it. Some people are going to like it a lot. So, you know, I don't know what misconceptions you're worried about specifically, but go get in Natasha's webinar. How can we teach our children about the pleasure side of sex, specifically utilizing vibrators or other toys as needed? Right, like, this is hard. Like, where am I being a creepy treehouse mom? Where am I getting a little too involved in my kids' sexual pleasure? I'll tell you how I handled it. I told my kids, look, I know you're masturbating. If you need anything, if you want anything, if you're interested in talking to me about it, I will. If you're not, then I won't. You know, as far as, like, vibrators or toys, like, there are other things I make them talk to me about, even though they don't want to, like STDs and condoms. But on, like, toys and vibrators, like, you can let go of that. Let them figure that out for themselves. If they want help, if you have that kind of relationship with your kid where they're willing to come to you, sure, talk to them about it. I'm going to guess that's not the case for most kids. All right. This last one, I don't think we have time to address.
Natasha, I don't think it was fair that you told about what you learned about the extra, and then didn't explain the biological, I forgot what it was,
the erectile?
Yes.
Well, just, so you want me to explain more about it? Well, basically, women have as much erectile tissue as men do. So that's interesting to know. But it's more wrapped up in different areas for us. And so therefore, for some women, especially, so vaginal penetration is not that great for women in and of itself. It's because of all these things that are surrounding the vaginal wall. Because the vagina really is not necessarily a sexual organ for women other than a receptacle for the penis. But why some women like it is because there's all these like sponges and the urethra is part of that. So it's as you're touching and orienting yourself to some of those areas, it can just feel very pleasurable. But a lot of women don't know that. Or it can even feel pleasurable to pee. Right, but a lot of women don't know why that is. Anyway, I know we're out of time. Sextalkwithnatasha.com is where I have all these webinars I've mentioned. I'm starting a new project called flourishintimately.com, and that's specifically for married heterosexual couples that are wanting to deal with how possible sexual shame and sexual constructs have gotten in the way of the sexual life that they want to have. So if you're interested in that, I've got some flyers. I'm also going on a cruise next summer. So if anybody wants to learn from me and party with me, that's an option. We have Symmetry Solutions, of course, is where we work. If you need more individual help, reach out to any of us, Facebook Messenger us or Symmetry Solutions message us, whatever. We would love to talk more. Give yourselves a hand. You survived. Ask a sex therapist. And I have some books too. Check Your Baggage. It's all about sexual messages that I think we need to let go of. So, all right. Have a great evening. Sunstone. Woo, woo, woo.